All right. I'm not used to having students that are off to my left that I can't even see. I hope they're not making funny faces at me while I'm... Oh, actually, they're talking while I'm trying to talk, but that's okay. That's all right, yeah. 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 Yeah, there's great seats up here. There's a great one over there. You know, they're not listening, but it's okay. By the way, Michael didn't really complete Philip's resume. You didn't mention his fame as a player of the guitar and all that stuff. And by the way, he was a minister for the church here about 43 years ago. And I believe he was 3 years old at the time. Right, right, right. Okay, so remember, we're dividing Daniel up into two parts, chapters 1, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And those are the examples of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and how they're staying faithful despite incredible pressures to compromise their convictions. All right, and then we now started the second part, which is the visions of the future, Daniel 2 and 7 through 12. And so the lesson or the message of the other chapters is how to be righteous in a world that's trying to get us to not be righteous. And then what's the main message of the chapters 2 and 7 through 12? God rules the nations. God's in control. All right, so let's go forward to that part there. Okay, visions of the future. Now, you don't have to get all the details here. Oh, yeah, thank you. You don't have to get all these things right. We're not going to have a quiz. But the more you remember, the better off you are. So what are those four parts of the statue? What was the head of gold? Babylon. What was the chest and arms of silver? The Persian Mede Empire. What was the belly and thighs of bronze? Greece. And the last one, everybody will get that one right. The partly iron, partly clay is Rome. And in the time of those kings, God established a kingdom that will never be destroyed. And the saints will possess it forever and ever. Great. That's Daniel chapter 2. Awesome. There we go. Then there's Daniel chapter 7. And who or what kingdom primarily was Daniel chapter 7 about? Nope. Not the Persian Mede Empire. Nope. It was about Rome. And it was about the 11th king of Rome, whose name was, and if you don't get the name right, that I'd say, hey, you know, you're doing pretty well already. I think I could probably focus this a little bit better. Could somebody head up there and get those microphones out of the way? Could somebody do that for me? Thank you. All right, great. So who was that 11th emperor? Domitian. And what did Daniel prophesy about Domitian? They would be very boastful, prideful. He would change the set times and the laws, and he would knock out three of the other horns. And that was prophesied around 650 years before the event. What was happening, you know, in California 650 years ago? Indians, that's a little bit of a non-PC way of saying it. So, you know, we're talking about, all right? Had Columbus made his voyage to the New World yet? No, that's how long we're talking about. And the details are amazing. Now, let's get to Daniel chapter 8. There's our friend Domitian. Daniel 8, the vision of the ram and the goat. Now, I kind of started this one a little bit and then stop in the middle? I don't remember. All right, now, nobody can remember either, so let's just do the whole thing. All right, great. All right. Last night I was doing a devotional for the Orange County Church, and the guy introducing me was Don Split, and he was a student of mine at Grossmont College 31 years ago. So there's some pretty good stories there that we could tell. Anyway, okay, great. So Daniel 8, starting verse 1. In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, I, Daniel, had a vision about after the one that had already appeared to me. In other words, he has the vision in chapter 7. Now he's having another vision. This is the third year of Belshazzar, 551 B.C., if you want to get the exact date there. In my vision, I saw in the citadel in Susa, in the province of Elam, in the vision I was beside the Ulai Canal. And by the way, there is the Ulai Canal, and there is the city of Susa. And if you're in Susa, looking across the Ulai Canal, you're looking directly to the west, which is very relevant to this particular vision. By the way, at the time, Daniel was not in Susa, but in his vision, he was in Susa. At the time, he was in the city of Babylon. Susa is one of the two capital cities of the Persian Mede Empire, along with Ecbatana. And there's going to be a quiz on that, Ecbatana. You got that? Okay, great. Anyway, I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns standing beside the canal, and the horns were long. One of the horns was longer than the other, but grew up later. I watched the ram as it charged to the west and to the north and to the south. No animal could stand against it, and none could rescue from his power. It did as it pleased and became great. Now, who might this two-horned ram be? I'll give you a hint. It's an empire that has two parts. Rome's not a bad guess. Not a bad guess. It's the Persian Mede Empire. And it says one horn was longer, but it grew up later. And what that's about is the fact that originally it was Media Persia, Media the longer one. But after Cyrus, it was Persia and Media. So the horn that was originally shorter but became longer is Cyrus. Now this is not an amazing prophecy because in 551 BC Cyrus was around. Now he hadn't started his great conquests yet, but that was within just a few years of this prophecy. But this prophecy is not primarily about Cyrus anyway. Anyway, it says that he charged to the west and to the north and to the south. Now, remember the three ribs that were in the mouth of the bear? Those were Lydia, which was to the west of Persia, and then Babylon, which was to the north of Persia, and then Egypt, which was to the south of Persia. All right, so again, we get the exact detail correct. But this vision is not about the Persian Mede Empire. No, it's not. As I was thinking about this, suddenly a goat with a prominent horn between its eyes came from the west, crossing the whole earth without touching the ground. It came towards the two-horned ram I had seen standing beside the canal and charged at it with a great rage. I saw it attack the ram furiously, striking the ram, shattering its two horns. The ram was powerless to stand against the goat. The goat knocked it to the ground and trampled on it, and none could rescue the ram from its power. The goat became very great, but at the height of its power, the large horn was cut off. And in its place, four prominent horns grew up towards the four winds of heaven. The year is 334 BC, which is around 220 years later. And the goat with the prominent horn, as you can see on the screen, is Alexander the Great, who was maybe the most prominent horn in all the ancient world. And he came from the west. He was about 21 years old at the time. He crossed the Dardanelles, which would be from what we'd say Europe to Asia. And he had 30,000 troops. And when he landed on what we would call Turkey, Asia, they literally burned the boats. At that time, the Persian Empire had a standing army of 200,000. 30,000, 200,000. The year was 334 BC. By 332 BC, Alexander had conquered the entire Persian Empire. One of the most amazing conquests in all time. Now, the way it's described here, it's like he was floating above the ground. Right? Then it says, at the height of its power, the horn was broken off. The year is 323 BC. Now Alexander's only 35 years old, and he died. And when he died, he was married to a woman named Roxana. She was a Bactrian princess. Bactria. Where's Bactria? Well, that's basically Afghanistan today. And she was pregnant, so he had no heirs. So what happened was his generals fought several battles over the next 3 or 4 years, and from that one massive empire established by Alexander, guess how many kingdoms emerged? Guess how many dynasties emerged?
Four.
Gee, what a surprise. And there it is. Antigonus, Cassander, Lysimachus, and Ptolemy. These are the four kingdoms. And these kingdoms lasted for between 200 and 300 years. The most powerful of them was Antigonus, the Antigonids, and they ruled over Persia, what we'd call Pakistan, Afghanistan, and some of those other stands like Turkmenistan and that area there. All very, very important for our story is Ptolemy, because Ptolemy will be the king of the south when we get to Daniel chapter 11. Okay, got it? So again, we see these prophecies. Now, what's the point? I mean, this is really cool. It's a nice little history, but what's the point? What's the point? God rules the nations. Okay? Out of one of them, you see, this vision concerns the Greek kings, and specifically it concerns Antiochus Epiphanes, who is the anti-hero in Daniel. Remember I said the principal audience of Daniel is the Jews suffering severe persecutions under Antiochus Epiphanes. And as we read on, you're going to find yourself probably agreeing with that. Anyway, out of one of them came another horn, which started small but grew in power to the south and to the east and toward the beautiful land. It grew until it reached the host of the heavens. It threw some of the starry hosts down to the earth, and it trampled on them. Now, this is called apocalyptic language. So we're speaking in very symbolic terms. It reminds you of some stuff in Ezekiel, especially in the book of Revelation. So basically, this is describing the judgment of God, the day of the Lord. And so God is coming to judge somebody. That's what the day of the Lord is all about. Anyway, it set itself up to be as great as the commander of the army of the Lord, and it took away the daily sacrifice from the Lord, and its sanctuary was brought low. Because of rebellion, the Lord's people and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. All right, now here's what actually happened. What happened is Ptolemy had a general, and his name was Seleucus. And Seleucus went and conquered Syria. I assume you know where Syria is. Syria was held by Antigonus, and he took Syria from Antigonus, and he said to himself, why should I give Syria to Ptolemy? So he started a fifth dynasty known as the Seleucid dynasty. And when we come to Daniel 11, the kings of the north will be the kings of the Seleucid dynasty, and the kings of the south will be the kings of the Ptolemaic dynasty. Now, Ptolemy and his successors controlled Palestine, Canaan. Anyway, so this guy Seleucus, he comes up and he starts conquering, and he grows first to the south. So from Syria, he took Babylon from Antigonus. And then he grew to the east, and he took Persia from Antigonus. And then he grew to the beautiful land. What do you think the beautiful land would be? Beulah, symbolically. I know Philip knows the answer. Go ahead, Philip. It's Israel. Now, what's interesting is it was actually not Seleucus who took Israel. It was his great-grandson. The year was 220 B.C. is when Antiochus the Great finally took what we would call Israel or Palestine or Canaan from the Ptolemies. All right, got it? Again, all accurate. And then it says, it grew until it reached the host of the heavens, and now we're talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. We're now talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, the one who created the abomination of desolation. All right, and again, you can read in the book of 1st or 2nd Maccabees. 2nd Maccabees chapter 7 is a great account. I mean, it's very, very intense of the kind of things that did, that happened. Now, what did Antiochus Epiphanes do starting in 167 B.C.? Well, let's read about it 400 years before it happened. Okay, got it? It says, he'll set himself up to be as great as the prince of hosts. And like I said, he sacrificed pigs in the temple and smeared the blood of pigs all over the holy place and the Holy of Holies. And he put a statue of Jupiter right above where the Prince of Hosts was, the mercy seat. And the face on the statue was the face of Antiochus Epiphanes. This is the most incredible blasphemy imaginable. This is the abomination of desolation, where the sacrifice came to an end. Now, we're going to see more about this when we get to Daniel chapter 11. All right? So, let's imagine that you are a Jew living in this time. It's now illegal for you to worship. No sacrifice. If you circumcise your male child, first they kill your child, then they kill you. All right? They were forced to observe sort of Greek customs. And in fact, let's actually read about that. Now, I had to get this Bible out. This is a Jerusalem Bible. All right, so we're going to go to, let's see, 1 Maccabees. Some of you might actually have this in your Bible, probably not. 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 41. All right, now, 1 Maccabees is right before 2 Maccabees, in case you don't know, but it's also after Esther. So if you have a Catholic Bible, you can find Esther, right? Just turn to the next page. Anyway, then the king issued a proclamation to his whole kingdom that all were to become a single people, each renouncing his particular customs. All the pagans conformed to the king's decree, and many Israelites chose to accept his religion, sacrificing to idols and profaning the Sabbath. The king also sent instructions. What king? Antiochus Epiphanes. He sent instructions by messengers to Jerusalem and to the towns of Judah, directing them to adopt customs foreign to the country, banning holocausts, which is sacrifices. All right, let me see. Sacrifices and libations from the sanctuary, profaning Sabbaths and feasts, defiling the sanctuary and the sacred ministers, building altars, precincts, and shrines for idols, sacrificing pigs and unclean beasts, leaving their sons uncircumcised, and prostituting themselves to all kinds of impurity and abomination, so that they could forget the law and revoke all observance of it. Anyone not obeying the king's command was to be put to death. Writing in such terms to every part of his kingdom, the king appointed inspectors for the whole people and directed all the towns of Judah to offer sacrifice one after another. Many of the people, that is, every apostate from the law, rallied to them and so committed evil in the country, forcing Israel into hiding in all their places of refuge. And it goes on and on and on. It started in 167 B.C. It was the most horrible time, really, in the history of the Jews before, I guess, the Holocaust that we think of what the Nazis did. So that's the kind of stuff that was going on under Antiochus Epiphanes. All right, now let's read on here. It says, because of rebellion, the Lord's people and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. Now, whose rebellion do you think led to this attack on God's people and on his temple? No. No. And it's because of God's people's rebellion. God's people had been unfaithful. So why did this come on them? Because they'd not been faithful to their God. And if we're not faithful to our God, God may come to discipline us. In fact, if you've been in our church for more than 15 years, you probably remember a time when God did kind of discipline us, you know? It didn't feel so good. It seemed like everything was falling apart, and we became convinced that we weren't even God's people. But what does it say in Hebrews that God does to those he loves? He disciplines them. All right? And so the bottom line is, if we start messing up, if we start becoming unfaithful, God's probably going to come after us. And heaven forbid that should happen, but you know what? If we become prideful and arrogant and begin to think it's all about us instead of all about Jesus, something like this just might happen. Let me tell you this. In all the history of Judaism, the greatest period of glory, other than the time of David and maybe Josiah, was the time immediately after Antiochus Epiphanes. That's when the Hasidim took control. And these were the righteous ones. This is when idolatry was eliminated permanently. Now, the Jews still had problems, but idolatry came to an end. It's when the Jews really reestablished their kingdom. During the time of the Maccabees, the Jews became independent and had their own, you know, Jewish kingdom after the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. So this horrible thing that happened to them turned out for the good for them. But how do you think they felt? If you had been one of these Jews, would you have believed at the time that God was in control of events? That's a good question for us to think about. Because either you believe God's in control, or you don't. And like we said, when are we tempted to think that God's not in control? When things aren't going so great. Have things not been going so great for you, maybe lately or at some other time? What are you going to do? Are you ready for that? And by the way, if you read 1 Maccabees, what you find is, although a majority of the Jews said, oh, it's okay, we'll kind of compromise, not a big deal, there was a hardcore of Jewish people who refused. And God built the kingdom around them. And it was a time of great victory. All right? So that's, I think, a great lesson for us to remember. You can read 1 Maccabees 1, verses 12 through 15. You probably don't have it with you. You can read about the building of the gymnasium and all the institute. Basically, this is a period where the fancy word is called Hellenization. In other words, he tried to Greekify them and to make them follow Greek customs rather than God, which is not a very good thing. Now, let's get down to the interpretation here. All right, let me see. Okay. Actually, now let's just read 13. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to him, how long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled? I'm in verse 13 of chapter 8. The vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, the surrender of the sanctuary, and the trampling underfoot of the Lord's people. He said to me, it'll take 2,300 evenings and mornings. Then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated. This is awesome stuff, folks. 2,300 divided by 2? 1,150. We don't know the exact day of the desecration of the temple. It was sometime in late November 167 BC. We know the exact day that the temple was reconsecrated, because that's called Hanukkah. Now, Hanukkah moves around in the calendar because the Jews have a lunar calendar, but in the year 164 BC, it was December 25th, which is kind of an interesting coincidence. So in other words, 3 years, 1 month, and a couple of days. You know how many days that is? 1,150 days. All right, so over 300, almost 400 years before the events, God told them the time of the desolation of the temple would be 1,150 days. And you're hiding in caves. Your family's been scattered. Your brother and your sister have been killed. Your wife is in prison. Your children are wherever. But it's been 1,130 days. You know it's 20 more days. And really, the book of 1 Maccabees is the story about Jacob Maccabeus and Matthias and all the other Maccabees, how they eventually kicked Antiochus Epiphanes out of Jerusalem and reestablished God's kingdom there for the first time in almost 400, actually almost 500 years. Since what, 605 BC? I'm sorry, 587 BC. So that's kind of cool. That's Daniel chapter 8. So we're beginning to believe that maybe God is in control and that God rules the nations. Now let's do Daniel 9. In the first year of Darius, son of Xerxes, a Mede by descent, who was made ruler over Babylon's kingdom, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood from the scriptures, according to the word of the Lord given to Jeremiah the prophet, that the desolation of Jerusalem would last 70 years. Now, Daniel is either reading what we call Jeremiah 25, 11 through 14, or he's reading Jeremiah 29, starting in verse 10. But one thing that's good is he's having a quiet time. All right, and it says the time of the desolation will be 70 years. This is the first year of Darius, which is roughly 537 BC, which means that Daniel's been in captivity for 68 or maybe 69 years. And he's reading that the captivity will last for 70 years, so he starts praying. And basically he says, God, you said it'd be 70 years. It's been almost 70 years. God, I want you to come and deliver me. All right, it's a great prayer. I don't have time to read the entire prayer, but I think it's worth noting a few things in the prayer. Okay, for example, let's look in verse 5 and 6 in Daniel chapter 9. It says here, verse 5. We have sinned and done wrong. We have been wicked and have rebelled. We have turned against your commands and laws. We have not listened to your servants, the prophets who spoke in your name, you know, to our kings, our princes. Now notice he says we. Had Daniel done those things? As far as I know, he didn't do those things. You know, and it's tempting to say, yeah, back then those people did this and those people did that. You know what we should say instead? We should say, back then, we did this. And we did that. You know, people say, oh, the Christians did the Crusades. You know, I say, oh, they're not Christians. Well, I don't know. They did it in the name of Christ. Maybe we should say, yeah, we Christians, we've messed up pretty badly sometimes. You know, the tendency is, when somebody does something bad, we say, they. But what if they is we? I really appreciate that Daniel said we did those things, even though he didn't do those things. I think that's a great thing for us to notice. Anyways, praying, and we're going to skip all the way down to verse 20. It says, while I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel and making my request to the Lord my God for his holy hill, while I was still praying, Gabriel, the man I had seen in the earlier vision, came to me in swift flight about the time of the evening sacrifice. He instructed me and said to me, Daniel, I have now come to give you insight and understanding. As soon as you began to pray, a word went out, which I have come to tell you, for you are highly esteemed. Therefore, consider the word and understand the vision. This is great. As soon as you began to pray, God was working. Isn't that great? When we pray. Now, we may not see the immediate result. In fact, the result of this prayer didn't come for 490 years. Actually, more like 550 years. All right? But God is in control. So then, here is the vision of the 77s. Verse 24. 77s are decreed for your people and your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. No one understand this from the time the word goes out to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes. There will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. It'll be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. 77s. That's 490. 490 what? Well, years. You know how I know that? Go back to chapter 9, verse 1 and 2. It concerns 70 years. Were those 70 years of captivity? Were those literal years? They sure were. 490 years. 490 years from the issue to the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Now, when was that decree issued? Well, in 538 BC, Cyrus issued a decree that the Jews could go back and rebuild their temple. If you want to see that decree, go to Ezra chapter 1. It's right there. But that was not in order to rebuild the temple. Now, if you remember, the Jews went back, and instead of building the temple, they put a nice addition on their house. They're building up their career and all their stuff, and they were not building God's house. So it took a pagan king, Darius, to tell them, guys, build the temple. And they finally did. And the decree of Darius to, guys, get building the temple, that's Ezra chapter 6. But again, that was not a decree to restore and rebuild the city of Jerusalem. The decree to restore and rebuild the city of Jerusalem was issued in the 7th year of Artaxerxes. So it goes Cyrus, Cambyses, Darius, Xerxes, and Artaxerxes. Now, Artaxerxes began to rule in 465 BC. So the 7th year of Artaxerxes is 458 BC. Did I forget to forward? Oh, it's there. You can see it for yourself. All right, now this is about 100 years after Daniel had this vision. And if you read in Ezra chapter 7, he says, go back and build the city. And how do we know that was a decree to rebuild the city? Because they went back and they rebuilt the city. If you don't believe me, read the book of Ezra and read the book of Nehemiah. They did it. Now, 458 minus 490 is negative 32. Got it? So what year would that be? 32 AD. Well, no, not really, because there was no year zero. You know the Y2K thing? They probably got it off by year, but never mind all that stuff. That's a geek thing. All right, yeah, it's a geek thing. All right, so actually, no, it would be 33 AD. So in roughly 33 AD, what's going to happen? Let me see. What's going to happen is that God is going to put an end to transgression. He's going to atone for wickedness. He's going to bring in everlasting righteousness. He's going to seal up vision and prophecy and anoint the Messiah. Anoint. Messiah. So in other words, this is a prophecy of when Jesus is going to come and die in Jerusalem. All right, that's pretty good. I don't know about you, that's pretty good. Now, actually, if you read the prophecy carefully, sorry to make it a little bit complicated, see where it says 7 sevens and 62 sevens? So that's 69 sevens. So what the prophecy is actually saying is during the 70th week, which would mean somewhere between 26 AD and 33 AD, the Messiah will come to Jerusalem and be killed to bring in everlasting righteousness and be anointed as the most holy. The fact is, it was probably 30 AD, was probably the year that Jesus was killed. I don't know about you, that's pretty awesome. Daniel prophesied what? Now, the Jews are still waiting for the Messiah. What's the problem with waiting for the Messiah at this point? You kind of missed the boat. Because it had to happen roughly 30 AD, which that was a while ago. Okay, so that's pretty cool. Now, I don't have time to get into... I have no idea how long I've been going. All right, I'm good. I've got about another, say, 12 minutes to go. That's perfect. Now, and then what happens is, he goes on, he talks about this, verse 26. After the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be put to death. Right? Yes? That's the crucifixion. All right? And will have nothing. The people, the ruler who will come will destroy the city. Now, this is about Vespasian and Titus. I already told you about Vespasian and Titus. This is the ruler. This is the same thing prophesied by Jesus in Matthew 24 and in Luke, I believe it's chapter 21, but if I'm wrong, I'm off by a chapter, you can forgive me. Remember, Jesus says, you'll see the city surrounded by troops. And when you see that, he said, flee from the city. And he said, like it said in Daniel. And he talks about the abomination of desolation. Now, when did the abomination of desolation happen? According to Daniel chapter 8. And the year is 167 BC, when Antiochus Epiphanes, killed pigs in the temple and put his picture up there and all kind of stuff. But Jesus says, no, you're going to see the city surrounded by troops, flee from the city, and that's when the abomination of desolation is going to happen. And that is the year 70 AD. So the abomination of desolation happened twice. A little confusing?
Yes.
All right. In 167 BC, pagan sacrifice was offered in the temple by Antiochus Epiphanes. Then in 70 AD, when Titus destroyed Jerusalem, he leveled the temple, burned it to the ground, and offered a Roman pagan sacrifice on the exact same place that Antiochus Epiphanes had offered a pagan sacrifice. All right? So basically then, Daniel, the book of Daniel, prophesies two different destructions, two different abominations, if you will, and he gets them both right. That's pretty impressive. Again, those who say the book of Daniel was written after the events of the prophecy, so what are we talking about? Can anybody deny what's going on here? Can anybody deny that it was fulfilled in 70 AD? If you don't know much about it, go ahead and read Josephus' Wars. He goes on and on and on about what happened in 70 AD. And by the way, if you go to Rome, when you're walking towards the Colosseum, you go past the Arch of Titus. There it is. And on the Arch of Titus, you can see carved in the side there, it's still there. And what it is, it's a picture of Jewish slaves carrying the items from the temple in Jerusalem through the streets of Rome. In fact, those slaves who were taken as captives as prophesied by Daniel in whatever 530 whatever BC, they're the ones who built the Colosseum. The people pictured in that carving there on Titus's arch, which is his triumphal arch from destroying the city of Jerusalem in 70 AD, those people built the Colosseum, which is pretty amazing. In Luke 21:20, Jesus says, when you see the city surrounded by the armies, get out of the city. And by the way, the church fled and they went to the city of Pella. According to Eusebius, no Christian was killed in the destruction of Jerusalem. None were killed because they heeded the word of Jesus, and they could have read it in Daniel as well, but Jesus was a little bit more specific. There he is, the man, Titus. All right, now we're in Daniel chapter 10. Daniel chapter 10. Now, Daniel chapter 10, 11, and 12 is the last vision. Now, this is the most intense vision. Oh, my goodness. This one knocked Daniel out. Literally knocked him out. I don't have time to read the whole thing. It says, in the third year of Cyrus. So this is around 535, 536 BC. So Daniel's now been in captivity for about 71 years. All right, he's been freed from Babylon, though. The king of Persia, a revelation was given to Daniel, was called Belteshazzar, and the message was true, etc. Now look, I don't have time to read it all, but look what happened in verse 3. At that time, I, Daniel, mourned for 3 weeks. Then in verse 8, so I was left alone gazing at this great vision. I had no strength left. My face turned deathly pale, and I was helpless. Verse 16, then one who looked like a man touched my lips, and I opened my mouth and began to speak. I said to the one standing before me, I am overcome with anguish because of the vision, my Lord, and I feel very weak. How can I, your servant, talk with you, my Lord? My strength is gone and I can hardly breathe. This is an intense vision. And it's a vision of the persecution of Antiochus Epiphanes against the Jews. Because basically it's a rerun. Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapters 10 and 11 are both about the same set of events, which is the kings of the north, the kings of the south, and the destruction, the devastation of the temple and all that. Now, I just went through chapter 10. That was fast. I'm now in chapter 11 because I only have about 8 minutes to go, so I better get going here. Okay, great. Now, let's go down to verse 5. Now, here he talks about the three kings and Cambyses and all that. I'm going to skip all that stuff. Got my notes. Get a copy of the book. I have 3 copies left. Pick up a copy of my book in Daniel. You want to get all that. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read from my book on Daniel. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read a historical account. So try, I've never tried this before. See if you can follow along. So I'm going to be reading the actual history of what actually happened from historical books that parallels what you're reading in the prophecy. Got that? Starting in verse 5. So let's see if this is going to work. And you can either go, no, it didn't work, or you can say, yes, it worked. So see if you can follow along. All right, verse 5. By 315 BC, Ptolemy I Soter, the founder of the Greek Ptolemaic dynasty, will establish himself in Egypt. In a battle in 312 BC with his strongest competitor, Antigonus, he will rise to become the predominant successor of Alexander. However, Ptolemy's greatest general, Seleucus, the one who defeated Antigonus, will break away from him to establish an independent dynasty in Mesopotamia. Eventually, his kingdom will become even greater than the southern kingdom of the Ptolemies. Verse 6. After some early indecisive struggles, the Ptolemaic kingdom and the Seleucid kingdom will agree to share power peacefully. In order to seal the deal, Ptolemy II Philadelphus will send his daughter Berenice to marry Antiochus II Theos, the heir to the northern Seleucid throne. This marriage in 252 B, etc. All right, could you kind of see how the prophecies parallel? All right, and we could go on and on and on. We could go on for like, whatever, 30 verses. And I'm telling you, exactly what Daniel said in 535 B.C., is exactly what happened. You can see the years and all that sort of stuff. So when you read about the king of the north and king of the south, we're talking about the king of the north being the Seleucid dynasty and the king of the south being the Ptolemaic dynasty. Now the purpose of this prophecy is not to impress you of how amazing the prophecy is. The purpose of this prophecy is so that we will understand that God rules the nations. Okay? Now let's skip down to verse 21. Now I'm not going to do this anymore. We'll be reading Daniel, but I'll be telling you what's going on here. Verse 21. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person. Who do you think this contemptible person just might possibly be? Antiochus Epiphanes. And so I'm telling you, if you read about what Antiochus Epiphanes did, if you read it in 1 Maccabees or 2 Maccabees, basically this is a summary of everything he did. For a while he was actually nice to the Jews, and then, what is it, verse, let me see. He'll go attack the king of the north, he'll go to the king of the south, and verse 30. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him and he will lose heart. So what happens is, Antiochus Epiphanes goes against Ptolemy to finally wipe him out and take over his whole kingdom. And he would have won, except Rome, you heard about Rome, right? This is in the 2nd century BC. Rome is a rising power in the Mediterranean. And Rome realizes that if Antiochus takes the Ptolemies, they're going to control all the eastern Mediterranean. So Rome sent a fleet to save the Ptolemies. All right, and to defeat Antiochus Epiphanes. And Antiochus Epiphanes, he was ticked off. So who did he blame? He blamed the Jews. And he came back and he began this terrible persecution that's described in verse 31. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. They will set up the abomination that causes desolation. Right, that statue there in the temple. With flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. All this is recorded in the first book of 1 Maccabees. You could read 1 Maccabees chapter 1, 4, 10 through 16, 1 Maccabees chapter 4, 36 through 40. Just read 1 Maccabees, okay? Anyway, verse 33. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. When they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, but it will still come at the appointed time. This is exactly what happened. So the Maccabees rebelled against the Antiochus Epiphanes. They were successful for a time, but then they had some not very, some people are willing to compromise, and they turned them in, and they got arrested, and they came back. The bottom line is, at the end, the wise shone. And Antiochus Epiphanes was kicked out, and the feast that we now call Hanukkah was established. The whole thing with the miraculous burning of the oil for 8 days and all that kind of stuff. It's pretty awesome stuff. Now, and then I'm not going to read Daniel 11, 36 through 45, but this is a prophecy of the final fall of the Greek kingdoms. Because like God said, hey, they're going to fall, but it's going to be in its own time. And this is the Battle of Actium, which is all kinds of details from the Battle of Actium in 31 B.C. That's when our friend Augustus, who is known as Octavian, became the emperor, prophesied by Daniel. That's minor detail here. Let's get to Daniel chapter 12. I'm going to be done in about 3 or 4 minutes here. All right, great. Now, this is the peak. This is the zenith. This is where we get our great encouragement. So let's spend a little bit of time here. All right, starting in verse 2. Multitudes will sleep and the dust of the earth will awake. Some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Now remember, what book in the New Testament is very similar to Daniel? Revelation. And Revelation, the prophecies in Revelation concern the things that happen in the next 200 or 300 years as the Roman Empire attacked the church and tried to destroy the church and the saints. And the end of the story is they lose, saints win. And then the last two chapters of Revelation fast forwards to the end of time. In the case of Daniel, in verse 2 of chapter 12, we're fast forwarding all the way to the end of time. And what is going to happen at the end of time? There's going to be a great resurrection of the righteous and the wicked. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awaken, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Now, I'd rather be one of those that rises to everlasting life than one that goes to shame and everlasting contempt. Did you know that the Old Testament doesn't talk about hell all that much? Did you know that? It's true. All right, but here is a scripture that clearly talks about the final resurrection. You know, the Sadducees and the Pharisees had this big debate about the resurrection. The Old Testament doesn't speak all that much about the final resurrection. All right, and the Sadducees were into the first 5 books anyway, but that's a whole side story. Let's get to the important stuff. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. This is awesome. Here's our evangelism passage. Those who lead many to righteousness will shine like the stars of the heavens forever and ever. You know, there's a lot of room up there in the heavens. I don't know how many stars can make it up there, but I'm sure it's millions or many, many millions. You know what? I believe that when I die, I'll be raised from the dead. When I was a young Christian, I used to think, I don't want to get cremated, because what would happen to my body if I get cremated? That's kind of weird. That's kind of weird superstition there. You know, I believe that when I die, I'll be raised from the dead someday. And I'll be raised to eternal life. I really believe it. You know why I believe it? Because Daniel said there would be 4 kingdoms. And the 4th kingdom would be a divided kingdom. And one side would be strong, the other would be shattered. Daniel said that in the time of the 4th kingdom, the 11th king in that 4th kingdom would attack the saints and would change the set times and the laws, and then he would take out 3 other kings and be prideful. You know what? That's exactly what happened. Daniel said that after 2,300 evenings and mornings, this terrible person who would desecrate the temple and abolish the sacrifice, that he would be kicked out of Jerusalem. And guess what? That's what happened. And Daniel said, during the 70th week, roughly 29, 30, 31 AD, the Messiah is going to come to Jerusalem and be killed And because of that, he's going to bring an everlasting righteousness. And that he will be anointed the Messiah. The same Daniel said all those things. What else did he say? He said, at the end of time, multitudes will rise from the dead. And Daniel is always right. So I believe it. You know, faith involves believing in things that are not seen. I cannot see my final resurrection. You know what? I believe it. I believe that those who lead many to righteousness will shine like the stars forever and ever. And then Daniel makes the mistake of asking for an interpretation of this vision. And basically in verse 8, the angel says, Daniel, just be quiet and do what I said. It's going to happen when it happens. He says, you know, some people are going to believe, some people aren't going to believe. You just do what I said. So you know what? I believe that God rules the nations. I believe the Bible is inspired by God. And I believe that at the end of time, we will be raised from the dead and we will shine like the stars forever and ever. Thank you.
Thank you, John, very much.
Great finish.
Thanks. We're happy.